Next case is entitled State of Ohio versus Denny Ross. Joining us from the 10th District Court of Appeals is Judge Sean Connor, replacing Justice O'Connor. Welcome. Mr. Meyer.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court. May it please the Court. My name is Matthew Meyer. I am here today representing the appellant, the State of Ohio.
Would you pull the microphone a little closer? We can't hear you, Mr. Meyer.
I apologize, Your Honor. I am here today representing the appellant, the State of Ohio, on behalf of Special Prosecutor for Summit County, William D. Mason. I would like to reserve, Mr. Chief Justice, 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The issue before the Court today in this case is the State's argument, Criminal Rule 45B bars any party in a criminal proceeding, whether it be a litigant or the trial court, from extending the time to take any action other than the precise, specific terms of Criminal Rule 29C. The Court of Appeals below, however, held that a judgment of acquittal in terms of Criminal Rule 29C is an interlocutory ruling that may be reconsidered by a trial court at any time prior to the final judgment under the Final Appealable Order Statute, Revised Code Section 2505.02. And we submit that based on the United States Supreme Court's decision in U.S. versus Carlisle, that reading of Criminal Rule 29 is erroneous and should not reflect Ohio's Criminal Rule 29, which in material respects is identical both in wording and an intent to the federal criminal rule that was at issue in Carlisle. The facts of this case that I think warrant reversal were the fact that on September 10th, 2003, 3 years after the discharge of the jury in this case, the trial court denied the motion for judgment of acquittal under Criminal Rule 29C. And from the State's perspective, that was the final ruling upon which the State could rely and then proceed in pretrial litigation to retrial. 2 days later, though, on September 12, 2003, Mr. Ross filed a pleading that he described as a renewed motion for judgment of acquittal, in which he was requesting that the trial court reverse himself and weigh the evidence differently than he had on September 10th, 2 days earlier. And I would just direct the Court to the very plain and unambiguous language in Criminal Rule 29C, which gives a party 14 days to either make or renew a motion for judgment of acquittal.
Do you think that a trial court has to act in 14 days, or do you think the motion has to be filed within the 14-day period?
Well, based on the terms of the rule, which I think the trial court has to abide by, and it gives the trial court the authority to act, the trial court can extend the period of time to consider that issue if the extension is done within the 14 days. And what makes this case, I think, important is that it did not do so after it denied acquittal. So after September 10, 2003, the issue is final. And I think the United States Supreme Court decision, which was
Mr. Meyer, you're saying that the court must actually rule on the motion within the time provided for in the rule, within the 14 days or 14 days with an extension made within the 14 days?
Well, I think the rule does not place any restriction on when the trial court should actually make its ruling. I think the superintendent's rules would probably be more appropriate for that. But in terms of the parameters with which the trial court can rule, whatever time period the trial court takes to rule on the motion it takes, then once it denies the motion, which happened here, there is no provision under law for the trial court to extend that time period once it is denied.
Counsel, I think this is where the confusion is, and I was a little confused by the briefs at first. Let me see if I've got the timeline right. The motion for judgment of acquittal was filed within the proper time.
Yes, I would agree.
All right. Then the court ruled. By the time the court ruled, it was past the 14 days, the time of the rule for filing. Is that correct?
3 years passed, correct.
All right. And then the defendant filed a supplemental brief or motion or essentially requesting either reconsideration or a judgment of acquittal. And your argument is that that last thing the defendant did was outside the time limit, so the defendant had no authority to file that, and the court, therefore, had no authority to rule on that one. Is that the sequence that you're arguing?
That is correct. There were three pleadings that Mr. Ross filed after September 10th. The first one was on September 12th. That was the renewed motion, which, by its very terms, Criminal Rule 29C says you cannot do. Then in November, or late October and November, there were two additional pleadings requesting acquittal under 29C that Mr. Ross captioned as supplemental memoranda. And it was that time frame after the denial of acquittal that we are saying under Rule 45B, which is captioned in very broad, unambiguous language, it does not say, it does not restrict the action to the criminal defendant. It says any action. And by its terms, I think that has to include the trial court.
So what you're saying is once the trial court rules on the acquittal, it's over.
That's correct. It is over.
And there is no provision for reconsideration or a renewed motion or a supplemental motion or any additional pleading to have that decision reconsidered.
That is correct. I think that is the teaching, the holding of Carlisle. And I would also direct the court to a case that was mentioned in the amicus of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association, United States versus Gupta, a 2004 case out of the 11th Circuit for Florida, in which the U.S. Court of Appeals followed Carlisle in, I think, facts that are exactly the same as the ones
at bar. Would you state that case again? I'm not sure.
United States versus Gupta. It was a case out of the 11th Circuit.
Thank you.
And the site for that case.
I can find it, I'm sure.
Okay. I think there
are two issues that are percolating in this one. This is where the court can reconsider its decision, and there's also the question of whether it can reconsider its decision if it was made outside the 14 days, and outside the 14 days the defendant is asking it to reconsider its decision. Those two concepts are getting a little confused in this discussion, and so I just point that out so maybe we can add a little clarity.
I think the clarity comes from the rule itself, and if the courts apply the rule, then the outcome is clear, because the rule says you may renew the motion within the 14-day period. After that 14-day period, a court rejects the motion. There is nothing in that rule that would say you can renew it again, you can reconsider it again ad nauseum. There is no finality if you read the rule that way.
Well, Mr. Meyer, let me ask. Let's assume for a moment that the defendant here did not supplement, and the judge, who may have just thought about the evidence, looked at his or her notes, and decided one way on the Rule 29 motion, then got the transcript, real-time transcript that was kept, and went back and looked at it sua sponte, and said, you know, I got this wrong. Doesn't the judge, on an interlocutory order such as the decision on the Rule 29 motion, have the ability to go back and fix his or her mistake?
Well, I would direct the court to the opinion in Carlisle, and this is a quote, petitioner's proposed reading would create an odd system in which defense counsel could move for judgment of acquittal for only 7 days, but the court's power to enter such a judgment would linger. And the instruction there is that the power to act, and that's what 45B says, the power to act is within the parameters of the rule. So the answer, I think, following Carlisle would have to be no. The trial court no longer has the authority to act sua sponte. And the court below and my colleague for the defense would suggest that there are only two possibilities here. Either it is a final appealable order under the statute, or it is interlocutory. And I am suggesting to the court that that is an incorrect analysis, because the rules themselves make this a final order, even though it does not comply with the final appealable order statute. The final appealable order statute does not govern criminal proceedings. It is the criminal rules themselves. And the finality in the rule is what needs to be applied.
So just if the judge concludes, after further reflection, that it made the wrong decision, the judge has no ability to fix that mistake, but must allow it to go to the Court of Appeals to fix it and send it back? Is that what you're suggesting?
That is the way the framers of the rules designed the system. It is a system that is based on finality and fairness to all litigants, not necessarily in respect to the specific facts of the case, but that issue, I think, was dealt with in Justice Ginsburg's concurring opinion. A criminal litigant has many remedies if there is a mistake or an issue of a miscarriage of justice, the first being direct appeal. But the Ohio Rules of Criminal Procedure and the post-conviction statute provide a litigant many remedies to bring an error to the court's attention to obtain relief. It does not have to be through improper acquittals.
Carlisle, though, talked about the power coming to an end once an appeal has been filed. And there is a statement there that says there is some point where the court is powerless to enter a judgment of acquittal, but the timing is once an appeal has been taken. That didn't happen in this case. I mean, even under Carlisle, it seems that the Rule 29 motion might have been considered.
Well, I can only go by the text of Justice Scalia's opinion in Carlisle, where he said there is simply no room in the text of Rules 29 and 45B for the granting of an untimely post-verdict motion for judgment of acquittal. And I don't understand how that holding can be read to say, but we are going to peg it for the time to appeal. The time limit is in the rule itself. And if the drafters of the rule intended to peg it for the time for an appeal or when a criminal case became final, which I would respectfully submit can be something of a moving target under the final appealable order statute, then we don't know when the case is over. And the rules were not designed that way. If you read it that way, we have a situation like the one in Lorain County where 15 years after a criminal case is resolved, we have judgments of acquittal with new lawyers and a new trial judge, which is the Smith and Allen case, also before the court right now. And even if you look at the facts of this case and the need for finality, I think the facts compel reversal, because what you had here was not true judgment of acquittal in the sense that a trial judge reviews the evidence that's been submitted at trial. What you had here was a hybrid proceeding in which Mr. Ross, even though he was arguing against retrial, was arguing new facts, new evidence, not before any court, that had only been developed pre-trial, post-mistrial.
Counsel, that's my question. The supplemental motion to me seems to be a new motion, which would not relate back to the original motion before Judge Bond. It had matters outside the record, so it wasn't. It's a new motion with new. Even though the judge said I didn't consider that, still the motion itself was filed with new matter, not before the original trial, and was not filed within 14 days of either the judge's motion of acquittal, the second judge, or the first judge. So you have a new motion here, don't you?
The new evidence is the elephant in the room, and I would respectfully disagree with the Ninth District, which called that an aside in Judge Sirigliano's opinion. It was not an aside. It made all the difference, and you just have to step back and ask, what changed between September 10th, 2003, and December 22nd of 2003? And that's the revelation that the so-called bite mark evidence might have problems. Well, if you're going to go forward and consider that as a detractor from trial evidence, well, what about the new DNA evidence under Ms. Hill's fingernails that matches Denny Ross? Shouldn't the state be able to argue that? But if you're going to go there, why not just have a new trial, which what this evidence compels? And that's what we're asking for. I see that I've expanded my time, and I respectfully urge reversal and reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Mr. Whitney.
Thank you. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, I think I'll begin with the statement that the facts of this case compel reversal. And I know that this is a long history in this case. My name became on this file in Summit County 10 years ago. And this kind of a time limit clouds this whole issue. We're talking about 3 years after the jury was discharged, this came up. And you know the history of this case, and it's been before you before, and you know that it's been in the federal system. So I'd like to extract that time because that's not the defendant's fault. That's not the state's fault. There was litigation. This case didn't become ripe in terms of Judge Sirigliano's opinion until 3 years have passed. And secondly, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty in this case, Your Honor. It was not perfected, but they returned three verdicts of not guilty, one of them being the rape in this case. So that is part of this case also. When you talk about the
counsel's arguing there's some DNA evidence, maybe they would have found him guilty, maybe not on the retrial.
Judge Sirigliano had a footnote where he talked about this dental evidence. There was a footnote of three lines in a footnote. That's what they're complaining about. That's this summary judgment they're talking about. That's just outside of the record. He recited all of the evidence in the case and said, by the way, in a three-line footnote that has come to our attention at a pretrial that even the state agrees that this dental evidence is not valid.
But the motion contained it, and the counsel argued it very strongly in front of the judge. So
he did.
When I'm saying it zeroes in on the motion, not what the judge said he did or didn't do.
Your Honor, if you read the transcript of that motion hearing, that Rule 29 motion hearing, you can see where Mr. Chestnoff, my co-counsel, indicated to the court, and everyone agreed, that that wasn't appropriate, was not appropriate. He agreed with Mr. Mitchell, who was the state's attorney at that time, and the judge, that was not appropriate.
It certainly wasn't appropriate, but doesn't it make it a new motion, which is outside the 14 days?
Your Honor, these are interlocutory orders. Judges can change their decisions in interlocutory orders. That's the law of this state. It has been the law of this state forever.
And that rule supersedes the civil or the criminal rule?
Which rule, Your Honor?
The one interlocutory order can be changed by a judge at any time. That the argument here is that this particular criminal rule changes that requirement. Why does this rule not change that ability?
The argument, Your Honor, is that Rule 45 changes this, and its correlation with Rule 29C changes this because, and the state is arguing, because everything must be done, any other act must be done within that 14-day period. And we know that's just not true. That's just... The only reasonable reading of that is that the motion must be filed within that statutory time.
Well, correct. I think there's two arguments at play here. One is everything has to be done, but the other one is that the defendant can't file a new motion outside the 14 days, and without that motion outside the 14 days, the court also has no authority to file its own motion outside the 14 days if it's already decided.
But that, you know, if we look at Rule 29C, it says, if a verdict of guilty is returned, the court may on such motion, meaning the defendant's motion, set, and this goes to what the Chief Justice asked, on such motion set aside the verdict and enter judgment of acquittal. If no verdict is returned, that's what we have here, the court may enter judgment of acquittal. It appears to me, as the Chief Justice hinted, that we didn't even need to file a motion. Any judge, that's what a judge is for, that feels that an injustice has been done. And if you read Carlisle, it makes fun of not fun, but it leads it to the ultimate conclusion that any judge has an obligation to render justice if he feels that, regardless of whether or not, and this statute permits him to do that without even a motion being filed. That way it looks to us. And I think Carlisle, I think, backhandedly agrees to that. If I do anything today, okay, and coming down here, I would ask the court to consider two things. There's a major difference between a judgment of acquittal entered by a trial judge without a verdict of guilty by a jury. Major difference between that. Carlisle was an NOV judgment. There was a verdict of guilty in that case. Virtually every case that the state cites, Your Honor, is a NOV judgment. This was not an NOV judgment.
But wasn't this a judgment entered on a motion for acquittal pursuant to Criminal Rule 29C?
It was, sir.
Okay. And the proposition of law that we've accepted is whether or not a trial court lacks jurisdiction to grant an untimely 29C motion.
Correct.
And And at least Mr. Meyer argues, if I understand it correctly, that a motion was filed, and I grant you, I don't know that a court has to rule within that 14-day period, but subsequent to that, there was a supplemental motion filed well beyond the 14 days, and then, as Judge Connor's pointing out, there was another motion, which may be akin to a motion for a new trial, but it came under the umbrella of a 29C, all of which are well beyond the 14-day period.
Correct.
And it's one of those that is the subject of this appeal. And the question I think we have is, does the court have the ability to consider a motion filed beyond the 14 days?
It doesn't.
It does not?
It does not. The rule
isn't
is clear.
Isn't that what Mr. Meyer is arguing to
Yes,
us?
It is arguing, but he's not right. He says that we didn't file it. We filed a motion for a judgment of acquittal within 14 days. When the judge ruled in a one-sentence order, by the way, the court put on an order that said all defendants' motions are overruled. One sentence, including the motion to perfect the verdicts, the motion.
Well, that would have been the motion for acquittal, wouldn't it?
It would have been. It said.
So if it's overruled.
It said motion, including motion for judgment of acquittal. Then we filed a brief 2 days later.
After the ruling.
After rule.
So it's a post-decree brief, but not a motion.
Well, that's right? They say it's a new motion, okay? I say that the judge.
And that was in the nature of please reconsider the motion that denied or
right.
overruled our acquittal.
That's correct.
And there's no provision in 29C to permit that.
There's no provision in 29C that says it can't be done either. It's an interlocutory order,
Judge. What
about
decisions of the United States Supreme Court, for example, when Justice Scalia says there's no ability to consider an untimely filed motion under that rule?
That's correct. If this court considers, okay, that we did not file within 14 days, then we're out of luck in terms of that. But I haven't finished yet.
Okay.
But I would agree with you. The statute says
take
we
your
have
time.
To,
you got 15 minutes.
I could talk for hours.
Most lawyers can't.
In this case. But what we're not considering and what the state doesn't consider is the jeopardy ramifications of the court's order. And that's why there's a major difference between a judgment of acquittal prior to a verdict of guilty versus a post-NOV. Jeopardy attached to Judge Sirigliano's ruling. And regardless of whether we like it, regardless of whether the state likes it, regardless of whether there's some legal problem with his decision, it doesn't matter. Jeopardy attaches.
Counsel, unlike, what if the judge had just taken that under advisement and had not ruled on the supplemental motion or whatever, the new motion, and let's assume they impaneled a jury, the case was tried to a jury, and we came back with the jury came back with a guilty verdict. And then is it your position, because we don't have a final entry until sentencing. So we haven't sentenced the person yet. Can the judge now go back and reconsider and acquit the person before the sentencing, even though a jury's convicted him?
According to the state, he could not, Judge. He's got to do it within 14 days.
Well, I'm asking you, though, according
I'm saying,
to your
obviously
scenario.
He can. Obviously he can, Your Honor.
What's the cutoff? What I want to know is what's the cutoff under this circumstance where you have a mistrial, you have a motion timely filed, the original motion. What's the cutoff when the judge can reconsider again? Is it the jury verdict on the second trial? Let's assume he doesn't
yes.
rule. Or is it the sentencing before sentencing? Do we have a cutoff? Yes,
Your Honor. We have for instance, in the Carlisle case, it was the date of sentencing that the court.
So we can actually have a conviction and an acquittal after conviction. I guess we do normally.
In a second trial, let's assume the judge did not rule in our favor. In a second trial, you mean I couldn't ask for a judgment of acquittal and could not the judge grant it? According to the state's theory,
on
judge
the basis
could not.
Of the first trial, the evidence that was presented at the
right.
first trial.
I mean, so I think the reading here is just all contorted.
So you're saying that the judge can reconsider his refusal to grant a motion for acquittal at any time before he's sentenced on the second case?
I am saying that, Judge. On a mistrial, yes.
And that's precisely the question I wanted to ask. If you have a mistrial, can you have a judgment of acquittal? You haven't completed anything.
Well,
how do you get?
Because Rule 29, Your Honor, says if no verdict is returned.
No, that's no verdict being returned. That refers to a hung jury.
Yes.
That doesn't refer to a court declaring a mistrial.
Well, I would think that a mistrial
words,
and a hung jury.
In other words, something is wrong here, and we're not going to proceed.
That's what happened here.
And if a mistrial is declared, how do you get an acquittal? How can you acquit a defendant if you haven't completed a trial?
The same way, Your Honor, you do it in a close of the state's case.
Do you know of any precedent where an acquittal has been entered subsequent to a mistrial?
There is one case cited in the briefs, a U.S. Supreme Court case, and I don't remember it. But you're right. It's very, very rare. This whole case is very rare. From the beginning to the end. So what I'm asking the court to consider, I don't know how much time I have left, Your Honor. I'm out of time.
You've got 3 minutes.
Okay. What I'm asking the court to think about is the interlocutory nature of this kind of a situation. The court has a right then to change its mind. And I think that the Rule 29 supports litigation supports that a court, even on its own, without our motion, could have done this. Secondly, that the finality of the acquittal in this case, once Judge Sirigliano, for whatever reason, determined it to be a final verdict, and that's what it is, when he granted a judgment of acquittal, jeopardy attaches. And why are we even here? I would ask the court to consider this an improvidently granted appeal, as I've done before. I don't know why we're here, because the statute prohibits the government from appealing, may appeal by leave of court to which the appeal has taken any other decision except the final verdict. They say it's void. They say this is a final verdict, but it's void. They want somebody to be almost pregnant here. It's either a final verdict or it's an interlocutory order, one or the other. If it's an interlocutory order, it can be changed, and it can't be appealed. We didn't have the right to appeal that first order. If it's a final order, then you have a right to appeal. The defendant does. The state does not. The statute prohibits the state from being in this courtroom. It's our position that the double jeopardy clause of the United States Constitution and our state constitution prohibit the state from appealing a final verdict, period, amen. And that's one of the fundamental concepts in our jurisprudence.
But this would not be true if the motion were filed outside the 14 days. You can't acquit. I agree with your argument that once the judge acquits, it's not that the state can't appeal it. It's one of those things under the statute. They can appeal. Obviously, the defense can't. But now you have a new motion filed outside the 14 days. So the state's appealing that issue, and we don't have a judgment of acquittal if we say this is a new motion, not timely filed. Do we?
Your Honor, if you look at the briefs, you'll see the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court's cases that we have cited, one of the cases in which the judge was dead wrong about the applicability of the capital murder statute. He was dead wrong. The court said it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is jurisdiction. Does the court have jurisdiction over the person of the defendant and jurisdiction over the case? Did this happen in Summit County, and was Denny Ross sitting behind me in the courtroom? That's what matters.
I note the federal rules have been liberalized under, I think it's 29, so the federal judge has much more discretion to reconsider motions for judgment of acquittal beyond time guidelines today, I think.
I'd ask the court to consider the jeopardy questions regarding the court's final decision in the case and the interlocutory nature of his first decision. I think when you do that, I think that you'll find that this was an interlocutory order that could be changed at any time up to the final judgment in the case. and that regardless of what Rule 45 says, or the state says about Rule 45, that's as to when the motion was filed, and we file briefs. I file briefs in cases until the judge tells me to quit filing briefs. I try to lay everything I can out to him that I possibly can. In this case, I think we filed another one. I think we filed a trial brief. And I don't know how that can be construed as a new motion. But if this court wants to do that, I guess we can. But we tried to present to the trial judge everything we possibly could.
Thank you, Mr. Whitney. Mr. Meyer, you have the balance of your time.
Counsel, if we start saying, okay, the judge did something wrong here before he issued this final verdict, so it's not really a final verdict, we go back and correct it, what happens to the jurisprudence we have established over centuries, essentially, on final verdicts not being assailable for any reason, pretty much? You're basically saying, well, there's some procedural error that occurred here and a time limitation, so it's not really a final verdict and jeopardy doesn't attach. Doesn't that have some serious consequences and finality? And I can imagine in numerous scenarios where you go back and say, well, the judge shouldn't have done this or shouldn't have done that, so it's really not a final verdict of acquittal. We can go back and correct it because he didn't have the right to do that procedural issue.
I think the drafters of the criminal rules drafted them in such a way that the courts would not have to get into the gray areas of what are and are not final verdicts, because the rule 45B and 29C, when read together, are so broad and clear that we don't have to ask that question. We don't have to decide what is and is not final appealable orders.
But for your argument that this motion was filed out of rule as a second rule, or the judge could not have considered, you would agree this is a final verdict?
I would not agree that it is a final verdict. Had Judge Sirigliano granted acquittal on September 10, 2003, that would be a final verdict which the state could not appeal.
So you're saying a procedural error prevents this from being a final verdict?
I am, and I would, again, direct the court to Justice Scalia's opinion in Carlisle, because a motion filed one day past the time limit of the rule is a motion filed one day that justice and equity demand. And I would also note that the Ninth District...
Does that case involve a final verdict?
Carlisle involves the question that's before the court is whether a judge has the authority, the power...
But it did not involve whether a final verdict happened, because he has a lot of cases in his brief where there were mistakes made by the judge, and the court said it's a final verdict, you can't go back and correct them.
I think the teaching of Carlisle, and I would also direct you to Justice Stratton to the Gupta case, is that it is not a final verdict when the court lacks authority to enter the order in the first place, and no party has the ability to even file the motion, not the defendant, not the court. And I would also note that the Ninth District based its reasoning on Criminal Rule 57, which I call the lookover provision, which says that if there is no rule of criminal procedure on point, then you look to the civil rules. And we have a rule of criminal procedure on point, and that is Rule 45B.
Mr. Meyer, what's the legal effect of the declaration of a mistrial in this case?
I think in Ohio law, to the best of my knowledge, the issue of whether a trial court could then grant acquittal has not been decided that I am aware of. So that would be a novel question that, should the state go on at retrial to convict Mr. Ross, I think would be before a court.
You can certainly retry a defendant after the declaration of a mistrial, because jeopardy hasn't attached to that proceeding. What I don't know is what the effect of a judgment of acquittal would be based on if the court has declared the proceeding that it conducted to be a mistrial.
Well, the operative term in Rule 29 would be discharge of a jury, and the question would be discharge of a jury after a properly adjudicated trial?
Well, when you have the discharge of a jury, though, that can be based on a hung jury or inability to reach a verdict on one count or another, and that's different from the court declaring that the entire proceeding that has been conducted is a mistrial and we will start over. Based on that, how does the court, on a motion, acquit a defendant based on what? If the mistrial is, in effect, a nullity.
And the state's position is that the mistrial should place the parties back in the position they were, a properly declared mistrial, as though no trial had occurred. basically we start over, and that's what we've always been asking for.
Well, you can't, if you're in that position, just file a motion for acquittal, can you?
I would submit that you cannot under the terms of the rule, that the terms of the rule say that you have to wait until the trial, the second trial, is over, and then the trial court could properly consider whether acquittal is proper within the parameters of Rule 29.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Marshall, may I close the court?
All rise.